keep sticking your finger.
Blog Talk Radio.
Tonight, from the highly anticipated film Rambo, composer Brian Tyler. Plus, from this year's Slam Dance Film Festival, director Tao Ruspoli and co-stars Olivia Wilde and Sean Andrews discussed the premiere of their new film, Fix. While from the Sundance Film Festival, filmmaker Marina Zinovich discusses her new documentary titled Roman Polanski, Wanted and Desired. It is all coming up next, a packed show on Movie Geeks United. Welcome to Movie Geeks United. Great Wednesday night show for you. And my name is Jamie, and Chris is here with us at the top of the hour. Hey, Chris.
I'm here. I'm trying to get over that Inagata DeVita length version of our opening music. holy shit. Am I crazy, or was it a little bit different, too?
It's a little bit different. It's a little bit different. It's got a little more of the 70s Superfly vibe to it. We're about to welcome a great musician on the show, and we're playing that as our theme song.
We got to get rid of that.
We got to do something about it. And, you know, it cracked me up because people listening out there, they don't realize that, you know, we call in, we check in with each other on the show line about 10 minutes prior to the show, and we're conversing, and I can only hear from my end, the person that hosts the switchboard, the countdown. So we're in the middle of conversation, and I know that the opening of the show picked it up. It was just a little blurb of something you were saying, and I don't know the context you were saying it, but you're saying, like, stick your finger in something.
I don't even remember. It was like it was 30 seconds ago, and I don't even remember what it was.
And I found myself laughing at that opening.
I reference something like that at least 5 times a day, so it could be anything. Who knows?
It could be. I give you that. But so that was hysterical. Jerry's going to join us later on the show. We're waiting the call from our first guest tonight, who is Brian Tyler, the composer of Rambo. And we got a great show. There's the film festivals galore going on now. The most prominent, of course, is Sundance. I think that starts tomorrow night, the first screening at Sundance. And one of the highest-profile projects there in the documentary competition is a movie called Roman Polanski, Wanted and Desired. It's from a director. Her name is Marina Zinovich. And she claims that she uncovered some groundbreaking stuff about the Roman Polanski case and why he fled the States for this documentary. So we can't wait to hear from her. That's fascinating stuff right there. And then we have some Slam Dance filmmakers, too. You know, Slam Dance occurs about the same time as Sundance, I think in the same region. And we hooked up with some of those filmmakers as well. So we're going to have a great, great show tonight. We're just waiting for the first guest to call. But let me go over, and Chris, I don't know if we've discussed this yet, some of our upcoming guests and upcoming shows. This Sunday, from the movie called The Air I Breathe, we have writer Bob DeRosa and director Jeho Lee. And The Air I Breathe, have you seen anything on this movie?
No, just what you've told me, actually. That's sounds pretty interesting, though.
Well, the cast alone. I mean, they look at the cast. Forrest Whitaker, Andy Garcia, Brendan Fraser, Sarah Michelle Gellar, Kevin Bacon, front-loaded with some amazing cast.
Yeah, there's got to be something there in order for all those people to be attached to it, you know. Got to be some really good writing.
Yeah, absolutely. And also, that's the first segment of Sunday's show, which starts at a special time, 5:30 p.m. Eastern, 2:30 Pacific. And then we'll follow that with a 90-minute tribute to filmmaker Alan J. Pakula. He produced To Kill a Mockingbird. He directed classic films like Clute, All the President's Men, Presumed Innocent, The Pelican Brief, on and on and on. Just so many great classic films. We're going to be discussing his work with his biographer, Jared Brown, and his screenwriter, collaborator on The Devil's Own, and a big protege, actually, of Mr. Pakula. His name is David Aaron Cohn. And David Aaron Cohn, actually, he also wrote the screenplay to Friday Night Lights, which he was developing with Pakula when he died tragically at the age of 70.
Oh, that would have been interesting.
Yeah, it really would have been.
I mean, it was a good movie anyway, but I think that would have been a lot different.
Yeah, yeah. And then we're going to welcome a great character actor. His name is James Siking from The Pelican Brief. He's been in so much great stuff. And then next Wednesday, we just received confirmation today, we are welcoming Philip Baker Hall, one of our, talk about a great character actor.
Sidney himself.
That's right, Sidney, and what was his character's name? Jimmy Gator, and Magnolia.
Oh, yeah.
Richard Nixon, he played for Robert Altman, and we'll also bring on the director of his new film, which is called Duck. Her name is Nicole Betauer, and I will get these pronunciations down by the time the show starts. I promise. Okay, are we all set and ready to go, Chris?
Yeah, let's do it.
All right, let's do it. Our first guest tonight was performing his own concert pieces across the U.S. and Russia by the time he was a teenager. Educated at UCLA and Harvard, this musical wonder found his way into film composing, contributing a series of diverse and beautifully realized scores for films like Panic, Bubba Hotep, Frailty, Constantine, Bug, and War. His two latest works are for the films Alien vs. Predator Requiem and Rambo, the latest installment of the wildly popular Sylvester Stallone franchise, which opens in theaters on January 25th. It is a great pleasure to welcome a terrific musician and film composer, Mr. Brian Tyler. Brian, are you with us?
I am. I can hear you. Can you hear me?
I can hear you perfectly.
Good. I'm glad it worked.
Thank you so much for being with us tonight. We're great admirers of your work, and we're crazy about film composition in general on this show. So thanks very much for being with us. I understand that as you were growing up, you had a kind of an insider's view into the film industry through your grandfather, correct?
Yeah, I did. You know, he was an art director. It was a different kind of wing of the movie industry. But yeah, you know, I grew up kind of hearing stories about him being on set doing his thing on these kind of, he did a lot of the biblical epics like Ten Commandments. He's an art director for that, and then did a lot of the John Wayne films, you know, and a lot of different films. Sabrina, there's tons of stuff. And
Roman Holiday, classic work.
Yeah, a lot of good things. And he was, you know, he knew I was really interested in film. He taught me how to edit. Just, you know, film the old school way, Moviola, with, you know, tape and the whole razor and all that. But at the same time, I was always a musician, always, you know, kind of writing music. So doing what I do now is just combining my love of, you know, what I gleaned from him and just film in general, being a film fanatic myself, and then combining it with what I naturally love to do, which is compose.
Yeah, but you play a variety of instruments. What was the first instrument you took to?
I'd say the first one was drums. Drum set was sitting around the house. My parents traded some speakers in for my sister, my older sister, to play drums. I was about four, so they weren't really thinking that I was going to play the drums. But I jumped on them and, you know, just kind of went for it. Probably a year later or so, started playing piano, and then eventually, you know, the guitar and bass and just various other instruments, and just kept on to this day. I mean, I'm still, you know, learning instruments. You know, my latest one, I bought a harp recently, so I'm learning the harp. So I just
well, that's a beautiful instrument.
Yeah, it's great. In fact, my harp debut is indeed in Rambo, like for about 10 seconds of harp playing. You know,
you use a harp in the Rambo score.
There actually is. It's the lowest note. It's kind of it's way down there, just you know, kind of doing this really low pulsing thing that no one will ever hear. I just wanted to technically say that I played a harp on a film score.
Well, actually, that's something that's pretty unique about you too. Is that you do play some of your own instruments in your scores.
Yeah, well, like Rambo, for instance, it's a massive amount. I'm playing all sorts of instruments from Thailand and from Asia, probably, you know, a good 30 or 40 percussion instruments on Rambo. There's also things like the charango and these kind of dulcimers from Thailand and all sorts of stringed instruments and bowed kumbhis and kind of more exotic kind of instrumentation that isn't found in a traditional orchestra. So we can get that, you know, since the locale of Rambo is, you know, out in Thailand at first and then goes to Burma, we needed something to contrast that was kind of a little bit more of the, you know, the locale to contrast also with the more traditional kind of what we know as Rambo music, you know, which is trumpet and the orchestra, and then, you know, of course, acoustic guitar, which is part of that the Rambo theme.
Right. And how important was that? Was that maintaining that original Goldsmith theme?
It was hugely important for me because, well, you know, here's the thing: I got a phone call from Stallone. You know, this is, I didn't know him before I did Rambo, and it kind of how it relates to the theme, we'll get there, but it kind of needs the story
strange
how it happened. So Sly calls in, he calls my assistant. I had just seen Rocky Balboa on DVD, I think the day before, and I got in an argument with a friend of mine because I really liked it, and my friend kind of didn't. And I thought this friend of mine, he's actually a director, I thought he called in just with the Stallone voice. You know, like, this is only hours later. He calls in kind of, I thought he was just giving me crap about liking Rocky Balboa. Right. And so he calls in, and it's actually Stallone on the line calling me because he was listening to my music, and he was writing the script for Rambo. He hadn't shot it yet, and he wanted me to do the score. So I pick up the phone, and it's, "Hey, Brian," and it's of course that famous Stallone voice. But
oh, yeah.
I thought it was just someone impersonating. I thought it was my friend, and so I kind of didn't really believe him. But it seemed the conversation was a little bit odd. You know, come into my office. It's very specific. So anyway, I did come into the office, the address given, and there he is. There's Stallone, and we meet. And the first thing he asks is, "Brian, if you score this film, do you think it's a good idea or not a good idea to, would you want to reprise the Jerry Goldsmith Rambo theme?" And I don't know if this was the deal breaker question or not, but but I unhesitantly said yes, because I'm a complete Jerry Goldsmith freak, and I love the Rambo series, and to me it just wouldn't be Rambo without that music. And he said, "Great, I think that's the way to go. Can we get some of that percussive, darker stuff that you do in there as well?" And, you know, so we kind of took it, and I had to make it, you know, we had to make it our own for this specific movie, but it's definitely in there, it's a real Rambo movie, you know.
It really is, and obviously it stands on its own with your magnificent work. It's a great score.
Thank
and
you.
At the same time, and I've seen message posts on some of your pages from your fans that say thank you for maintaining that Goldsmith touch as well. And what, tell me about that Goldsmith score. Can you put it into words what that single, it starts out with a single horn, that theme that he has for Rambo, what that expresses about that character?
Yeah, you know, I mean, I think the great thing about solo, you know, it's done on a solo horn and it's done on a solo trumpet. The idea is that this guy is a loner, you know. I mean, he just can't seem to make it work. He's not accepted in society, you know, all these things that we see from the very opening shot of First Blood. You know, he's this guy that just is never able to kind of fit back in. And the same thing, the start of this movie, of Rambo, he's on his own, he's doing his thing, and he just can't really relate, he can't really have relationships. So it's that lone solo instrument that it really evokes that the kind of disconnect he has and the fact that he is lonely in a sense and kind of the last warrior, you know, and that holds true really throughout all the way from First Blood. I think Rambo 2 really works to use that idea. Rambo 3 kind of got a little, we became more of a buddy film, you know, which we kind of went away from, and Stallone wanted to go back to the tone of First Blood. And and so it was almost even more important to use the Rambo theme in this than it was in Rambo 3, in a sense. So, you know, anything soloistic like that seemed to just be really haunting and poignant for the character.
Yeah. But in terms of where Rambo goes in this film, Rambo's journey, and in terms of your scoring work, did you wait to write anything until you saw a rough cut, or did you start in the scripting stage?
Yeah, I couldn't really help myself. I mean, you know, he gave me the script before they shot it, and it was really cool. You know, I felt like I was getting a sneak peek at, you know, something that I had grown up with, you know, series.
Yeah.
Like, what's going to happen to John Rambo? You know, I mean, really, it's hard to separate the fan from the, you know, the composer sometimes.
Absolutely.
So right away, yeah, I did start thinking of themes, some of the, and also kind of marking up the script as to where I thought that we could reprise the original Rambo theme, and then kind of work in some new elements. The thing that's kind of different about this film is it's got a realistic aspect to it, in that you know, you have this whole, there's atrocities going on in Burma today, you know, still, and it kind of almost, it starts off with newsreel footage. It's all real documentary footage, and so it's got, whoa, you know, you kind of are thinking that you're just going in for this just ride, but there's a realistic element to it, and the fact that there's this kind of thing going on where all these people in Burma, these villagers that are just really minding their own business, they're getting slaughtered right and left. Some, you know, there had to be a really significant other theme to the movie besides kind of the lonely heroic Rambo theme. It just didn't it didn't fit them. You know what I'm saying? And so. So there's kind of this other theme in the movie that I wrote that could reflect where the story went, instead of trying to force kind of a theme that didn't work over those sections. So there's a multiple themes in it, but they connect throughout the film in various ways, and they're kind of you know, in a way they play off each other.
Yeah, they complement each other. You know, I've heard interviews with Stallone on this film, and we've been trying to get Stallone on the show. We can't wait. But okay. I've heard interviews with him where he's talked about the most difficult part of putting this movie together was just that, doing something that will satisfy the action fans, the hardcore action fans, and honoring something that is a real life tragedy. I mean, that's currently still going on.
Yeah, and I honestly, I didn't know a whole lot about it before I saw the first cut of the film. You know, even reading about it, I was a little detached.
Yeah.
In a sense, like, you know, you read numbers, you kind of list how many people are killed and this and that and every year, and it's like, wow, that's tragic. But then once he showed me the first cut and I saw those, the opening frames of the film are just one shot after another. It's unreal. Like, you know, mass graves. Children with, you know, they amputees and macheted. I mean, it's
that's
just incredible the how violent and terrible it is. It really rocked me back, and then I started going on the internet and kind of trying to find out, you know, what, how could this be happening? And it's kind of near Somalia like, and it's and it's anarchy there. And I think Sly did a great job with taking something that is real, trying to kind of, you know, it's not a message movie, and it's but it does expose you to something that's real, and because of that, it feels kind of more jolting, the violence and the action, and it kind of hits you differently than it does in just kind of a purely fictional tale, and I had to kind of take that into account when scoring it. You couldn't do it. There was the one time someone made a suggestion. I won't say who, and what certainly wasn't from anyone on the creative team, but an executive made kind of a suggestion that we do just like over this scene, the rock music, you know, that was like, you know, a big hit song from, you know, a metal band or something. And it was like, whoa, I think you're missing the point here. If you do that, it's making light of it and kind of, you know,
I think he got his wish on the trailer. I think they're currently playing that on the trailer.
Yeah, well, exactly. In your trailer, you kind of don't know what's going. You know, what I mean,
yeah.
you're detached anyway. You're kind of just. But when you get in that movie, and you would, if they would have done something like that or the movie,
yeah.
Oh my God, you know, it just would have been hideous. So
a little disrespectful, yeah, in a way.
Yeah, it really would. It's like, wait a minute, guys. You know, but you know, we've all, anyone that's working in the this business, you know, the executive comes into the editing room or whatever, and he's like, uh-oh, here comes the suit, and often when they open their mouths, something like that does come out. And, you know, the good thing about Sly is he's a really strong kind of force in
yeah.
the sense that not many people mess with him, and kind of what he says is final, and he wanted this to be purely score. It's the entire movie is score, you know. It doesn't have product placement songs. It doesn't try to MTV out or anything like that. It's not that kind of thing. And even at the end, when the end credits come up, you know, there was a lot of suggestions. Let's put in such and such rock song, and we go with the Rambo theme, you know. And
yeah.
I think that will stand the test of time more than something that immediately dates your film, and
that's right.
also undermines the point of it.
Well, I'm hearing you speak about how. You look at the content and kind of live inside of the movie in a way to start composing your themes, and it reminds me, we had Christopher Lenertz on the show last week.
Hey,
and yes, and he compliments you on Alien versus Predator. He wanted me to tell you he loves the score.
Oh, great!
And he was explaining the role of the composer, and he said that it's not just about being a great musician. You have to be a great dramatist as well. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I mean, I think half of it you really have to have a kind of the film bug, I guess. You want to be able to tell a story through the music. It can't just kind of be lacquered on and become this sonic wallpaper. I think that's the danger sometimes. You know, there's a lot of great writers that could write great music that are either in the pop world or the classical world, and then sometimes when they try to make the jump into film composing, it just kind of doesn't work somehow
yeah.
because they're not really film people. But, you know, I came from the side of, before I was even scoring films, I had, you know, I would shoot short films and I would edit picture, and so I kind of somewhat have that line into what it takes to dramatically build something up and you know, kind of the ebb and flow of storytelling, and that's something that I always like to, you know, really try to get from the director. You know, when I'm working on a movie, what are they trying to say with this scene? You know, I don't need to hear a director say, "Could you use D minor 7 with a viola?" That doesn't help. You know, it's more like, okay, this is what I'm trying to say in this scene, and could you steer it this way? And you kind of get the whole tapestry of the score, you know, and once you step back and look at the whole thing and it really works, you know, that's when you feel like you've done your job right.
It sounds like Stallone was a great collaborator, an ideal collaborator.
Yeah. Yeah, no doubt. He understands what music can do in a film. You know, I mean, you look at Rocky, you know, and how that's so integral to the you can't separate it. And it's the same thing with Rambo. You know, he really felt that music was going to be a big part of it, and he knew that it was it's like, you know, handing off this important job to this guy, you know, me. and he just had, you know, there's a certain amount of trust that has to go into it, no doubt. And we just had to have that relationship where you say, okay, I'm trusting you to be the heart of this kind of movie, especially with his acting, which is very subdued. He doesn't emote a lot. Kind of the idea is Rambo's exterior is just like stone cold, but inside there's all this, you know, tortured emotion going on. And
like,
the only
like
way
the great,
you can do that
yeah.
with the music. So
yeah.
It was, you know, and also just stepping in for, you know, in the shoes of – one of the legends, Jerry Goldsmith, is, you know, that was...
Was he one of your kind of film composition idols?
Oh, yeah, no doubt. Major. I bought all the, you know, his records growing up and then CDs, you know, and followed his career. And you know, I mean, it was... We've had lots of crossover over the time. I actually, you know, I replaced them on the score for Timeline, which is really, really strange, because, you know, it's like, you know, he had scored Timeline originally for Richard Donner and then was let go, and then I ended up doing the actual score. And, you know, of course, this is a guy that before I was actually hired, I signed an online petition to get Jerry Goldsmith. I was angry. You know, I was like, bring him back on, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
I actually signed the petition. But then, you know, I scored Star Trek Enterprise. He did Star Trek as well. And then I did Aliens, which he, of course, scored the original Alien. And we kind of have this weird, you know, link, which is great for me just because, you know, I idolized the guy
as long as
I can remember since I was 5 years old, you know.
I want to ask you, before we let you go, I want to ask you about some of these other collaborations. There's a few directors that you work with on a kind of a regular basis, and I wanted to know what makes these collaborations special for you. William Friedkin is one.
Yes, yes. Friedkin is, you know, he's a guy that, I mean... he's like a legend, and he's got a whole personality onto his own that's pretty famous and infamous, you know. So for me, you know, we've developed a bond somehow. You know, he's never used composers over and over. He always kind of has moved around his whole career, and we kind of hit it off in a way that now we work together on all of his movies, and there's a huge age gap, you know, and all this. But somehow, you know, we're kind of the odd couple, you know, and we totally get along, and we're coming from different, completely different, you know, angles. But he's someone that feels that music is incredibly important, and that it's where we meet, you know, philosophically on a film, and there's nothing better than kind of being able to talk to the director about, so what was it like directing Exorcist and such and such?
I
mean, it's
I bet.
Insane, you know, there's such a history there, and he's directed some of my favorite films, and even some of the ones that are considered failures are some of my favorite films. So it's pretty cool, and the guy knows his stuff. I mean, he in his spare time, you know, he goes and he directs major operas, you know, when he's not filming movies. So that's someone, you know, that we'll keep going.
There's another director that you've worked with on both of his films, and the films couldn't be more different, but they're both just so exceptional. And I'm talking about Bill Paxton.
Oh, yes.
With Frailty and The Greatest Game Ever Played. What is he like as a collaborator?
Bill is he's one of those guys that I think he can direct pretty much anything. You know, and I think that's what he was trying to say after Frailty, is doing a movie that was so different with The Greatest Game Ever Played, you know. And I was kind of the same way. I wanted to do something completely different. At the time I did The Greatest Game Ever Played, this kind of pastoral Americana kind of score.
Sure.
And so it was cool to kind of, Bill being a second-time director by the time I did that, and I did his first film that was so dark and so twisted and tweaked that we were able to both go in a completely different direction. But he's a film historian. He completely, like, the stuff that we talk about is often films from the 40s and, you know, through the 60s, and that's kind of his area. And you know, in fact, when he heard some of my music just randomly when he was trying to figure out who would score Frailty, and he called me in because he wanted to surround himself with Arnie Glassman and like in the cinematographer, all these guys that were old school, and he thought for some reason that I was like a 70-year-old or something. I don't know where he got that. When I walked in, he was shocked, you know, that it was like me, this guy, and he's a little thrown back, but somehow he felt that maybe my music kind of had some of that feel, and so we're continuing on. We're working on something together that's a long time in the works. What he's doing with Tom Hanks, that's coming out in 2011, actually, about JFK. So
that's right. That's right. It's I read about that about the Oswald story and the
yeah. It's pretty amazing. And it's going to be, you know, a pretty massive undertaking. But you know,
I bet it will be.
Should be cool.
I'm sure it'll be exceptional, like all of your work, and we admire you so much on the show. And just to let the audience know, Alien vs. Predator Requiem is currently in theaters, and I would imagine it's in record stores as well. And
yeah.
The Rambo opens up January 25th. Your soundtrack score will be available on the 22nd on iTunes and February 5th in stores.
Yes.
But I appreciate you coming on.
Sure. Well, thanks for having me.
We're big fans of you on the show. Come back anytime you like.
Okay, we'll do. We'll talk to you soon.
Thank you, Brian. Bye-bye
right.
now.
Bye.
That is Brian Tyler, composer of Rambo and just a great many other additional scores. I mean, just talking about those movies, Chris, and those collaborations, can you imagine how much fun it would be to score a movie like Bug? You know,
oh
if
my
you're.
God.
Yeah, yeah. Or Frailty. I mean, we're talking about great movies here.
Yeah, you know, like he's talking about Bill Paxton, for instance, and like it sounds like he's really developed a kind of relationship with some of these people, Paxton and Friedkin, where they keep coming back to him. Obviously, they're coming back to him for a reason because he's, you know, seems to be a really good collaborator, seems to have something these guys like, so that's really
yeah.
awesome.
And I think that that's a very, very important for a composer. And you look at some composers and some collaborations between director and composer, and they pretty much sometimes they stick to a same composer throughout their career. You know, they
yeah,
might veer off.
Like, Spielberg, for instance, you know, with John Williams. Like, why go with someone else when every time out of the gate he hits a home run? So,
and that's
have one of those careers.
That's the prime example of a director and composer who are so kind of intertwined. You know, John Williams is almost his voice, and Spielberg has said that. You know, he feels like my voice, my inner voice. I'm amazed by film composition and that kind of talent.
Well, it's pretty amazing. Like sometimes it's hard to believe. Like for instance, with Spielberg and John Williams. It's hard to believe that is such a major element of the movie, like Jaws, for instance. It's such this, like that movie always seems like Steven Spielberg's, like, singular work, or Close Encounters is another one. But it's hard to believe that music actually came from another mind. You know, everything else came from Steven Spielberg, with the exception, of course, the source material in many instances. But that music, that's a whole the movie does not work without that great music.
Spielberg said it himself. He said that they screened Jaws for an audience without the music, and it was unimpressive. And the second they put that music in, it was a complete 180. The movie became terrifying. It became an event.
And it is great when a director is strong and says to the company, "No, I'm not going to put in if you want to put Drowning Pool, Let the Bodies Hit the Floor in the trailer, that's fine.
Yeah.
But the movie is going to have a score because it's so much better." You know, rarely there's a few and far between are there times when pop music is better than score. Very rarely, score is almost always better.
I feel the same way. I feel the second you kind of put that kind of stuff in there. It becomes a faddish kind of movie, which could work for your movie. I mean, there are movies built on pop songs that you wouldn't want it any other way.
There's some movies like Juno recently. Juno was perfect with pop music, or The Graduate.
Yeah, Cameron Crowe films, you know.
Exactly. But a movie like Frailty, for instance, or, you know, like Rambo is another good example. Why would you want that? Like, it doesn't fit. That's not appropriate. The characters wouldn't listen. You know, John Rambo wouldn't listen to heavy metal music. Like, that's ridiculous.
He wouldn't listen to any music. He's in the middle of nowhere.
Exactly. He might be in the middle of nowhere listening to some random village boy play some obscure instrument.
Yeah, he's probably listening to He's listening to Barry Manilow in his tent there.
Well, talk about it.
Okay, Chris, it's been great fun. I appreciate you joining us on this first segment, man. And I guess we'll see you on Sunday.
All right, yeah, man.
All right, man. Thank you so much.
All right, see ya.
Bye, bye, man. Now we're joined by fellow movie geek Jerry. Jerry,
hey,
hello.
Up?
Hey.
What's up?
Hey, our two guests are on the line, and we're all up and ready to go.
All right, sounds good.
Okay, let's do it. Let me comb down to this interview segment here. Okay. Director Tao Ruspoli's Fix is one of 10 independent films vying for the Narrative Feature Award at this weekend's Slamdance Film Festival. This darkly comic film makes the most of the diverse panoramic that is Los Angeles, and a stellar cast of characters played by the likes of Olivia Wilde, Sean Andrews, and Dee Dee Pfeiffer. Sean Andrews has done stellar work in films like Dazed and Confused, and Matt Dillon's directorial debut, City of Ghosts. Tal Ruspoli is a multi-talented filmmaker, writer, photographer, documentarian, and musician whose prior films include Just Say No and Flamenco, A Personal Journey. It is a pleasure to welcome to the show actor Sean Andrews and director Tal Ruspoli. Let me bring them up here. Gentlemen, are you with us?
I'm with you. Hey, I'm
here.
Hi, Tal. How are you doing? And the other line's open, too? I'm sorry.
Yeah, I'm here.
Sean, you're there? Okay, great.
Yeah.
Thank you both for joining us tonight. And Tal, did I pronounce your name correctly?
You did pretty good, yeah. Tal Ruspoli.
Ruspoli, okay.
This is so cool because I'm driving right now a 1977 GMC RV up to Sundance with my whole crew, and we just pulled over by the side of the freeway up somewhere like between Las Vegas and Salt Lake City.
Oh, that's got to be exciting, man. I mean, how do you feel? You're about to premiere the film there, and what's going on in your stomach right now?
Oh, well, it's super exciting, and it's funny because this RV was also, we made the whole film out of one vehicle. As far as, like, you know, we had like 36 locations in LA, and we had a crew of about 12 people, and this was our only vehicle for hair and makeup, grip, electric, wardrobe, everything. And now to be with the whole crew, I've got some of the actors, the producer, the editor, and the cinematographer, and we're all rolling up the slam dance. Super excited.
I'm thrilled for you, man. It sounds like it was a real kind of guerrilla kind of production. Tell me a little bit about the film and your inspirations for writing it.
Well, the film was inspired by true events. It's a story of two brothers. One is has a heroin problem and has to be bailed out of jail and gotten to rehab by 8 o'clock at night, or he's going to go to prison for 3 years. And basically what happened was I had a similar situation with a family member of mine.
Yeah,
we shall remain nameless for now. But you know, his lawyer called me and said, you know, he had 10 days to enter a. The judge had given him 10 days to enter rehab, and on the eighth day he got arrested again for something else. And if somebody, and tomorrow was the 10th day, and I was in San Francisco working on a documentary, and somebody didn't come down and bail him out and get him to the rehab. By, you know, 8 p.m. the following day, he was going to go to prison for 3 years.
Oh, wow.
So then, you know, then we get down there and we found out that we needed $5,000 in cash to even check him into the rehab, and we didn't have that money. So we went on this search to borrow and find the $5,000. So out of that real experience came the inspiration for Fix, which was a fictionalized account of a similar story.
And it really sounds like it's a movie as you're watching it. You can really feel the clock. I mean, there's an urgency to it, I would think, with
there
that time.
There absolutely
timeline.
Is.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a great setup. But, you know, they say as a first film, you should always try and compress. You know, you don't want to try and take on years of narrative. Like, so I thought this was a perfect way to go from my background in documentary into narrative filmmaking. To take a story that's shot in the documentary style, it's actually shot in the first person by the brother who's doing the saving or attempting to save, and the whole thing is shot as if it was a documentary and it was actually happening and he was documenting the day.
Yeah. I want to ask you about that because I knew your history of documentary filmmaking, and just from the setup as you've explained, I would think that would. Those skills that you picked up from that medium would transfer well to this particular story.
Not just that medium, but more specifically, you know, I spent 7 years traveling around in this funky school bus called the LAFCO bus. LAFCO stands for Los Angeles Filmmakers Co-op, and that was started in 2000 by me and a couple partners, and we outfitted this bus full of editing equipment, and we, like, traveled around the country getting people to jump aboard, teaching, you know, guerrilla filmmaking and engaging in guerrilla filmmaking ourselves. And this involved everything from, you know, doing short documentaries to on-the-fly music videos for people like Dead Prez and The Outlaws and
oh, wow.
all sorts of like really cool underground but potent, you know, musicians and artists. And our idea was to like bridge the gaps between the arts, you know, introduce musicians and poets and painters to the digital media.
Absolutely.
So,
that sounds great. Sean, tell me when you read the script, what about the script captured you?
I thought it was really honest. I thought it was really funny, and I think it was one of the best scripts that I had read in a long time. So
yeah.
I liked the fact that everyone in their own way was affected by my character. Everyone was working through something, not just my character, including Tao's character and Olivia's character and Megalyn's character. So
yeah,
I liked it. It was one of those rare scripts that combined something really powerful to say, but at the same time did it in a way that really kind of entertained you, which is really kind of rare, you know.
And it seemed kind of clear that it was an actor's piece as well. I mean, it was tailor made for an actor to give quite a performance.
Yeah, it was a really I'm very grateful for the opportunity that I got, and to both Tao and Olivia and the producer Nat and everyone involved in it. And
tell me about your character Leo.
Well, my name is Kilo, and Sean is Leo. Yeah.
My character is loosely based or inspired by Tao's brother, and he's just really I'd say somebody who's always charming people. He's really sort of a charismatic guy, and somebody who doesn't really sit still. I don't know, it's tough to put him in a box, you know what I mean? It's like when I started working on the role, it just kind of took over. it's tough to like explain that, but
Is there a because I know this is an indie project, and I know that it probably moves at a faster pace than a bigger budget film might. Does that affect the way you work, or do you think that makes for a stronger performance?
I like it. I think that, personally for me, I mean, we did a lot of rehearsals, a lot of preparation beforehand, so that really helped a lot, and I like the urgency. Obviously,
yeah.
The story has a lot of urgency, so it played right into making everything kind of authentic. It actually really helped kind of getting it sort of as real and as authentic as possible.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah,
and the feeling of constant movement, and the feeling of, but also, I mean, the one thing I really like about Leo's character as well is he's always kind of trying to have a good time wherever he is. Even though Milo's character, played by Tao, and Bella's character, played by Olivia, really want to get him to the rehab, you know, it's almost kind of like he has another agenda. I mean, I don't want to give it away, but. He's having a good time along the way. Let's just put it that way.
Yeah, and I can feel that from watching the previews to it, that this film has a real momentum about it. And I think that goes hand in hand with the kind of guerrilla style it's done in. Because you hear these stories about, you know, the big budget projects, you're waiting more than anything else. And that kind of puts a damper on the creative spark, I would think.
Oh, something.
Yeah,
Go ahead, Tal.
No, as somebody who just saw the film recently commented that it just never falls off, she said. She's like, you know, most films you wait, like you just said, and then stuff happens, and then this film, like, it never stops from the beginning to end, and it slows down just enough for you to really get to know the characters every once in a while. It becomes more meditative, but
yeah.
It's always moving, from literally through the city, but also just narrative-wise, it's just always moving.
So Tal, tell me how you wanted to portray Los Angeles.
Well, Los Angeles is kind of, in a way, it's hell, because we've done little things with like Greek mythology throughout the movie. Like Leo's character, his nickname is Hermes, and Hermes, as some of you might know, was the god of crossing boundaries and the guy who took you around the underworld.
Yeah.
And at Leo, in his, you know, addiction and his all this the underworld that he navigates through, is this guide to it's not in LA that you usually see. I mean, we go to see addicts and crazy, you know, losers that have, you know, lost that owe Leo money. And but each one is much more charming and more interesting than you would expect. It's not so dark. It's funny, but it is a dark place. And we end up in Watts in the projects. Is one of our last stops, and there we mixed real documentary with the story, and I just happened to ask one of the guys, like, playing dominoes there in the project, like, what's it like here, and he said, literally, it's like hell, and, you know, so it's kind of a funny but dark place, L.A., and very diverse, and it was like, as if we're crossing around the world in this one city. It's a microcosm of the whole world.
Yeah, and you would think as much as they shoot in Los Angeles that they'd run out of places to shoot. But, you know, seeing the preview to your film, it seems like you're really utilizing some locations that haven't been seen before necessarily. And it reminded me somewhat of what Michael Mann does with L.A., with like a movie like Heat. You know, the multiple L.A. locations and parts of it that you've never seen on film before. Was that something that you're striving for?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I love LA, and I think it's many worlds. It's kind of a perfect postmodern city. It has no center, and it's just like lots of localized worlds. And someone who arrives from outside might see nothing in LA,
yeah.
And might just see like a bunch of suburbs, you know, or there's no center really. But then if you dive in, each of these localized worlds that are created by groups of people and their circumstance. Can perfectly represent a larger world, or, you know, our larger world, I think.
Yeah. So did you have, this is all told through the point of view of which character?
Of the older brother, Milo.
Okay.
Played by me.
Okay. So you ended up being the camera operator for the film, or?
Yes. I operate most of it, but I had a co-director of photography named Christopher Gallo, and that was very great to have a collaborator that could provide fresh eyes on a scene, because, you know, I was living it, acting it, shooting it, directing it, and so it was a fine line finding the balance of just like doing it off the cuff and also making it set up and cinematic. And I think we really pulled that off. I think that it's stylized enough, there's enough cutaways that keeps the editing interesting. And yet it's still natural enough that it feels like it could actually be happening.
Yeah. Sean, I asked Tao what his feelings were when you're I think it premieres on does it premiere on the 18th?
Yeah, it premieres Friday night at Slamdance.
Yeah, and what's going on with you, Sean? Do you have any jitters about it, or how are you feeling?
Yeah, you know, I mean, anytime you show your work, you feel a little jittery about it, but I'm really proud of this film, and I think that it's gonna hopefully affect a lot of people.
What do you want people to take away from it, Sean?
Ultimately, no matter how badly you go out of your way to help somebody, people are gonna do what they're gonna do.
Yeah.
Which is good. That ultimately is, I think, the message. Like, no matter how much you love somebody or you sacrifice for them, people are going to be who they are.
Yeah.
Like, you can't change that, no matter what you do.
And believe me, we've got a story like that in practically every family in America. You know, I think it's something that all of us can sympathize with and relate to.
Can I add something to that?
Yeah, please, Tao. Go ahead.
I think the deeper message of the film is that while you can't fix people, just showing up and trying is enough. And you may not get the results that you want, but just showing a little love and care goes a long way. And it might not be the way you want it to go, but it does have an effect. And I think that's what people will come away from the movie, because the connectedness that you feel from people by caring and getting involved is more important than some dream results that you have in mind, or some like idealized vision of what you want to do with another human being or with the world.
Absolutely. Before we go, Sean, I want to ask you about City of Ghosts.
Sure.
Which is a movie you did with Matt Dillon. That was largely shot in Cambodia, wasn't it?
Yeah, all in mostly Phnom Penh, yeah.
And what was that experience like? That's a tremendous film.
Yeah, that was a mind-blower, man.
great
first of all, yeah, I mean, Matt Dillon, first of all, I remember being a little kid and watching The Outsiders, and then I remember seeing Drugstore Cowboy, and I just think he's really a, kind of a special, one of the rare cats out there that are the real deal. And,
yeah,
but,
absolutely.
But as far as the experience itself, it was amazing because on one hand you have this majestic, beautiful land, you know, with a lot of the... a lot of the history there, and then on the other hand, you have a lot of the depression and the sadness and what happened, you know, with the war there. So it's a weird combination of beauty, tragedy, and it really affected me. I mean, I remember leaving that film just you just realize whatever you think your problems are, they're nothing compared to people who really suffer. So and,
absolutely, yeah.
Right.
Yeah, I can sense that in the film too. Is that the location is such a character in the film itself?
Oh yeah.
Much like Vix, I would imagine with L.A. So Tal, you guys are about to premiere. Are you looking for distribution at Slam Dance or what's going on in that film?
We're really blessed because the Cassian Elwes and Rena Ronson at the William Morris Agency fell in love with the film. And they're repping it for sales, and it's the first time they've repped the film at Slam Dance.
Wow.
And they actually screened for dozens of buyers just before we went up, and so we're hoping to get a good distribution deal with it, yeah.
Well, I am really excited for all you guys, and be sure to drop me an email or call into our show and let us know how it went. We're dying to know.
Oh, we'd love to. Can we tell people the website to look at the trailer? And
please, go right ahead, yes.
So it's Fix the Movie, F-I-X, fixthemovie.com.
.com, fixthemovie.com.
Yeah, and you can see stills from the film, and you can see, different trailers and links and stuff like that, I think.
Yeah, I encourage everyone to check that out, fixthemovie.com. Best of luck to you guys with the film, A Slam Dance, and like I said, keep us posted, guys.
Yeah,
thank you so much.
Hello.
Good luck.
Sorry that you couldn't be here.
Oh, that's fine. It's been great talking to both of you. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Okay.
Bye-bye now.
Thank you very much.
Bye. Thank you. Bye. That's Tal Rispoli. And did I get that right that time?
I think you did. I think congratulations.
It's Sean Andrews, the new film Fix. And you could feel the excitement.
I actually liked that. Was great. Both of those guys are so enthusiastic. They made you want to go to, like, Slam Dance right now and check that film out.
I know. I wish I was at Slam Dance right now myself, but or Sundance, you know. And we're
both
about
them.
To
both of them, you know.
Yeah, both of them simultaneously. If I could be split, you know.
Yeah, because we could clone you. And
yeah, you can't clone perfect, but you know. how's the chat room looking, man?
The chat room's great. Joe Wilson, Anthony T, all of our friends are in here, so we're doing good.
I haven't been able to pay attention to it during the interview.
No, we're talking about the strike right now.
All right, I thank everyone for being with us tonight and joining us in the chat room. If you have anything to add to the show, our number...
Feel free to drop us in there. I'm Cinema Junkie. Jerry is Cinema Junkie, so feel free to ask a question and we'll try to get it. Or feel free to call in.
Call in. Our number here is 718-508-9477. We're about to welcome a very fascinating guest. And this is something that I'm really looking forward to, because you and I and our appreciation of cinema, and like so many countless people and fans of our show, and we have a great admiration for Roman Polanski's work.
Yes, we do.
And his life is one that is, I think it's as tortured as it is celebrated.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, he made some dark films early in his career. Anyway, I would imagine Rosemary's Baby being the classic
Tenet.
Example. Yeah, The Tenant.
And they made a comedy, though. Don't forget then also the comedy The Fearless Vampire Killers, which
yes.
I only saw a couple years ago, which is great.
Yeah, he's got such a distinctive style and such a way with the thriller genre, particularly.
Yeah. You know, and then he comes a couple years ago and makes this movie The Pianist, which really I think. More so than the Death and the Maiden and then Bitter Moon.
Yeah,
just
yeah.
Really blew the lid off everything.
He says it's his favorite movie outside of Chinatown. He said The Pianist is my favorite, and then Chinatown. The pianist is deeply personal to him. This is what I'm talking about with Tortured. You know, he and his father survived Auschwitz, but his mother was killed there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
His pregnant his wife and unborn child were taken by the Manson family.
Right.
And then this incident that occurred in the mid 70s, where he was accused of statutory rape of a 13-year-old, and he fled the country, and he hasn't been back since. And there's a new documentary that our next guest made on that subject, because apparently there's more to the story than that. But it premieres at Sundance this weekend, I believe. But you remember, even as recently as his win at the Oscars and the Globes for The Pianist,
right?
The whispering, will he come back to the States? You know, and if he does, police were waiting to nab him.
Yeah. That was always there. It was always, you know, you heard that. And, of course, of all places, the Drudge Report is where this was headlined, you know, headlined, big, bold, black letters. About
but this was like a this is a, going on over a 30-year-old case.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was speaking to my friend, and he's in the chat room now, my good buddy Eric, and we were talking about is there statute of limitations on something like this? Do you have any idea of that?
No, I don't know. I don't. From what we talked about last night and the night before about this documentary, I want to know everything. You know, because obviously it's like what you said. We don't know everything, and this documentary has some answers or some reasons that we don't know about. So I'm very curious.
Yeah,
I want to know why he's not. You know, if he. God, can you imagine what would happen if he came back here?
I don't know. I don't know that anything would happen.
I don't think I gotta say, you know, if we're really that hung up on with all the stuff that's going on right now, and if our priorities are on Polanski, we got really all right, you know, hey, you know, the stock market's crashing, the housing market's a bust. Oh, let's nab Polanski when he comes in.
Yeah.
I mean, come on, let's just give it
He's been terrorizing this country for 30 years.
Yeah.
But
even
in that time,
hour 3, isn't that punishment enough? Hasn't he suffered enough?
At that time, he's made some great films.
Oh, he has.
The time that he's been in kind of exile, you know, people have talked about that it hasn't reached the status of his earlier work, like Chinatown or Rosemary's Baby. But how many movies do? I mean, from any director,
it's really hard. And don't forget Knife in the Water too.
One of his first that he made out of Poland.
No, but I like Frantic. I like Death and the Maiden and The Pianist. I even like, you know, he made, was it, Oliver Twist a couple years ago? Remember
Yes.
It didn't do very, it wasn't very well received, but it was interesting, though.
Yeah. Didn't he just make that? I thought that
was I want to say 2005.
Yeah, that was his latest project.
Yeah, that was it. And he was attached to Robert Harris's, they were going to make a movie out of Robert Harris's book, Pompeii, which he would have been perfect for, but... I guess because it was very expensive, that might have fallen apart, but I think he's going to do Robert Harris's other book, The Ghost, which is about a prime minister like Tony Blair. So he's got a lot of stuff. He's got a lot of irons in the fire right now, so.
Yeah, and unfortunately he had one major bomb.
Pirates.
Which is so odd because two of the biggest bombs, Pirates and Cutthroat Island, and you would think you can't make a pirate movie make any money. And
I know.
Lo and behold, Pirates of the Caribbean.
Yeah, I remember everyone, and you know, people brought those two movies up the year before and the months leading up to that film, you know, saying, oh, it's not going to do well. Look at Cutthroat Island. Look at Pirates. It's just a dead genre. Well, Johnny Depp proved them all wrong.
Yeah, and don't underestimate the power of Jerry Bruckheimer.
How
we've gone from Polanski to Jerry Bruckheimer, I have no idea. But let's take a little minute while we're waiting for Marina to call in to tell us about her Roman Polanski documentary. I haven't been able to speak to you about the Golden Globes. You know, obviously, they were the regular kind of show was canceled in favor of a news broadcasty kind of thing. What were your impressions of the presentation? Not necessarily the winners, but the
presentation. I didn't mind. Well, the winners I have no problem with. I don't know if it really matters in the long run. But the presentation... Now, we complain, we say the show's too long. I'll take the older format to this. This was awful.
It was terrible.
I mean,
the commentary, I told you the other night, the commentary alone from Billy Bush, and I don't know what the woman's name was, but I was just like, you've got to be kidding me.
Is this like Access Hollywood, or is that what it is?
I think they're Access Hollywood, and I only see it with captions on at the gym. I've never heard Billy Bush's voice.
Yeah.
So when I heard it I was like, you've got to be. And he's got this hair that looks like it was made by Dow Chemical or Monsanto. And I'm just like, you've got to be, you know, I just couldn't. We kept flipping back to the Terminator.
Well, he is a member of the Bush family, but not holding that against him. I mean, if you still look and listen to what he said on Sunday night, Kate Blanchett took home Best Supporting Actress for her portrayal of Bob Dylan, and he made a comment after they announced the winner. I didn't think that that would take it home. It didn't seem real challenging to me. It just seemed like a woman playing a man.
You know,
which is the most ludicrous comment. It's just a woman playing the opposite gender. You know?
You don't see that every day. The last time I saw that was Linda Hunt in The Year of Living Dangerously. So
And there was a question of, like, we'd never really seen Linda Hunt before that, so we could buy into the fact that she might have been, you know, a man. But Cate Blanchett, I mean, she's a gorgeous woman.
Yeah.
And here she is playing Bob Dylan more convincingly than most of the other actors in the film, if you believe what you read with the critiques.
No, I gotta say, and going back to that, she's great in the film. Here's the thing: everyone is great in that film. So I thought giving the Spirit Award for the ensemble,
right,
was the way to go, because everyone knows she's very good. Don't get me wrong, but everyone in that film is good. If I was watching that and I was the guy, you know, Gil Cates of the Oscars, I would be on the phone, like, when did that go on? That went on at, I guess, 9 o'clock?
Yeah.
I would have been on the phone 9:02. We have to end the strike.
Yeah.
We can't let this happen to the Oscars.
It can't happen to the Oscars.
No,
I mean,
did you hear they have two shows planned either way, if the strike is still going on and if the strike ends? And, you know, they're very resilient at the Oscars. They didn't think they were going to do a show while the Iraq War,
right,
you know, was going on. They 3 days before they decided to come together.
You know, I remember that Iraq War Oscar telecast,
yeah,
and it was hosted by Steve Martin, wasn't it?
I think so.
And I remember in Steve Martin's opening monologue, it had to have been a difficult night of all nights to take a global stage.
Yes.
There was a light fixture or something that fell onto the stage in his opening monologue, and there was such a tension in the air already.
Mm-hmm.
Just a difficult night, and difficult too to be kind of self-congratulatory when we're in this kind of conflict. You know, when the world is in this kind of conflict.
Right. Yeah.
But I've always felt that the Oscars are very special. I've always held them very dear to me. It's kind of like I feel like a kid again watching it and dreaming. You know. But I will say the award shows have gotten a little out of hand, and they've become a little too self-congratulatory when you have one every weekend this time of year. It does get a little much for my taste. But
right. No, I agree. But I think actually, I got to say something with the we have so many good films, and I don't think anything's a foregone conclusion. Although I do want to bring, if we have time, I do want to bring up two developments since the last time we talked. The BAFTA.
Very quickly, our guest is on the line.
Okay, the BAFTAs, Atonement got the most nominations for the British Academy Awards, followed by No Country for Old Men and There Will Be Blood. But also the foreign film shortlist, I haven't seen any of them. For a best foreign film Oscar, none of the things that you thought would be on there are on there.
Really?
Really. We'll talk about that later, but that just really, that was the most shocking thing I read last night.
Yeah, that's odd. We'll take this a little bit of the segment following this interview, and we'll discuss a little bit more on this. We're really excited about this segment. Like we said before, this is fascinating for us. So here we go. You all set?
Yes, I am.
Okay. Man the chat room. If there are any questions that come through, just let me know. Early in his career, Roman Polanski promised to be one of our most versatile and brilliant directors, weaving from the domestic and supernatural terrors of Rosemary's Baby to the gritty and heavily stylized film noir of Chinatown. To this day, Polanski continues to produce the occasional masterwork, 2002's The Pianist, a prime example. but his life and his art forever changed following the murder of his wife and unborn child at the hands of the Manson family in 1969, and his conviction for the statutory rape of a 13-year-old girl, a charge that inspired Polanski to flee to Europe, a country from which he has never returned for the past 30 years. And the new documentary film Roman Polanski, Wanted and Desired, director Marina Zinovich, explores this 30-year-old saga, and in the process uncovers deeper truths both about the incident surrounding Polanski's escape from the U.S. and the inner workings of a deeply flawed legal system. The film premieres at the Sundance Film Festival, where it is nominated for a Grand Jury Prize. Wow, that's terrific.
Yeah,
we are honored to have Marina Zinovich on our show tonight. Marina, are you with us?
I am from the parking lot of Whole Foods on Sepulveda Boulevard in Los Angeles.
Oh wow!
I don't think my location is worthy of your intro. My God,
I love Whole Foods.
It's not my choice. I've been out in the car all day, and this is where I ended up between one screening and picking up the tape that I'm bringing tomorrow to Park City.
Wow. What does this feel like? We just interviewed some filmmakers that have submitted their film to Slamdance, and they're playing there, but how does it feel, Sundance? It's so prestigious, and you're days away. How does that feel? How are you feeling right now?
It's weird. You know, everybody, I get these emails like, congratulations, you're on the... what did someone say? It's, you know, the A-team and all this stuff. Until you get there, I mean, you're just another struggling filmmaker who's trying to get your film finished. But it's a huge honor, and I'm thrilled, and I can't wait to see the movie with an audience. It's screening five times. I mean, it's, you know, I'm Cinderella for a week.
You actually made a documentary called Independence Day, and it's about the film festival and some of the talents that
yes.
surrounded it. Yeah.
And it screened at Slamdance 10 years ago. So I feel like an old-timer. I made that, and I shot it in 96 and 97 in Park City. It was the beginning of Slamdance. It was the beginning of Slumdance, which I think no longer exists. It was before kind of this insanity. Well, we thought it was insanity then, but, you know, now it's kind of, it's changed. I haven't been there in 4 years, but I went for something like 9 years in a row and followed the struggles of, you know, various people at different levels, from Steven Soderbergh to Dan Mirvish, who's one of the founders of Slamdance, to Larry Fessenden, to Eric Schaefer, Tom DiCillo, Neil LaBute.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of want to do a follow-up, because it'd be interesting to see kind of where everyone ends up.
You know, and I think that you might find the inspiration to do that on this visit. I would be very interested to know how that atmosphere has become even more kind of frenetic and supercharged, and, you know. So definitely, you'll have to come back and share your experiences this year with it. But first of all, tell me about your film. And first of all, what kind of subjects as a documentary filmmaker do you find yourself most attracted to, and how does the Polanski story fall into that?
Well, it's funny. It's hard to find something that you're in love with, but I guess it's like meeting someone. You know, when you find it, you know. You know, Independence Day was my first documentary, and it was a light bulb that went off in my head when someone said, oh, there are these three guys who started this film festival called Slamdance because they didn't get into Sundance. And I just thought, oh, my God, this is something. And then my second documentary was something called Who is Bernard Tapie, about my obsession with this French former politician, convicted criminal turned actor,
yeah.
who I saw act in a movie, and I found out he was an actor to pay his legal bills, and it was just kind of like, you have these moments in your life where you're like, I have to capture this and do something with this. And for the Polanski story, I'd really been struggling. It's kind of like, was I going to find something like Tapie, which to me was just a great experience. I'm a total Francophile. And I didn't know what I was going to do next. And then it'll be 5 years ago this month that there was an article in the LA Times. It was January 2003. The article was, if Polanski gets nominated for The Pianist, will he be able to come back? And then I thought, oh, I remember this story, and I'd always been a Polanski fan, and then the girl and her lawyer ended up going on the Larry King show, and her lawyer said something that really stuck with me, which was, the day Roman Polanski fled was a sad day for the American judicial system. And I was like, what? That doesn't make sense. Hmm. So it's like these ideas just kind of, they capture you almost, and you can't shake them.
Yeah.
And then I found out that I knew someone who knew the DA in the case, and I think he was going to be hard to get to because he was retired, and then I knew someone who happened to be Roman Polanski's godson, and then these little signs show up, and you're like, oh, God, here's another 5 years. You know? But, I mean, I just was fascinated with this story, and it was really something that I found that so many people have opinions about. So many people think they know exactly what happened, and a lot of people don't. I mean, there is a whole story about the judicial kind of maneuvering behind the scenes that no one really knows. And I, after a lot of kind of sweet-talking and begging and, you know, sweet-talking and begging, basically, I got everyone to talk, everyone except Polanski, because I'd never really approached Polanski until the end because I didn't really know what he would say. I felt that it was very much a story that the lawyers who were there dealing with the now deceased judge, they were the only ones who could really tell the story.
Right.
So,
right.
Did
you get any reaction from Polanski when you finally went to him?
Well, he hasn't seen the movie, but, you know, he met with me, I think, because he was, you know, probably astounded that I'd spent so much time kind of researching and interviewing so many people about this. I mean, I asked him if he wanted to be interviewed, and it was interesting. He said that he thought it would look like self-promotion, and you know what? He's right.
Yeah.
So I don't think that we need Roman in the movie. I went to him because, of course, I would love to interview him, but I think the movie stands on its own without him, and he's throughout the film. I mean, it's really a film about something that happened 30 years ago, so it's an archival film. So
yeah.
There's a lot of archive of him, his voice, his image, and it's not a present-day film. It's not a biography. It doesn't go through all his movies and his life.
Right. Even so, I mean, we were discussing before you came on, I can't think of a filmmaker with a life that's been so kind of tortured and celebrated at the same time. And at the time of this incident, he had this was a few years after the Manson incident.
Right.
He was kind of hot again with Chinatown, wasn't he?
Yeah. She died in 69. Chinatown was 74.
74, yeah.
And then it happened in 77.
Oh, 77.
Yeah.
So what? I know you interviewed. Did you interview the girl?
I did.
What's your feeling for Polanski now, and how has that changed over the years?
Well, I think it's a sad story for everyone involved. You know, I think it was a mistake, and everyone's had to live with it in their own ways. She publicly forgave him, and that was part of the reason that I wanted to make the film, because I didn't know why. She seems to have dealt with it and just wants to move on with her life, and has. You know, it's just something that gets brought up, and then she gets the phone calls, and then I think what she doesn't like is, it's almost like the two of them are living in some sort of, they're stuck in some electronic hell or something, because it's really, people just really seem to gravitate towards the real sensational. I mean, how can you not? But there's another story here, and that's the story that I was trying to tell.
I wanted to get to what that story was, because we all know the what we've been told for the past 30 years, that he was accused of statutory rape. He fled to Europe to avoid imprisonment, and he's been there for 30 years.
But that's wrong. See, you have your facts wrong because everyone does. He was in jail. I don't want to give it away.
Right, okay.
That's why you have to see the movie. But everybody thinks that he fled because he was afraid to go to jail. And that's wrong. He did go. So that, I mean, I remember when Michael Jackson was arriving at the courthouse, and of course I was watching it. I mean, wasn't everyone? And yeah. And people were talking about different celebrity cases, and CNN, I think, gave some wrong facts about Polanski. It's like everyone gets this wrong.
Well, that's
just it. Why
everyone is under this false impression, and that's why your movie's so fascinating. This is what I've been told that I've read for the past 30 years what occurred.
Right.
So this is a really kind of fascinating documentary for me. So is it all in the legal system and the wranglings in the legal system where?
Go ahead.
No, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, I mean, yeah, it's about, I mean, despite what Polanski did, and, you know, I never try to lessen the seriousness of what his crime was. Polanski pled guilty to unlawful sexual intercourse and went to jail and was under the impression that his time would be the time served.
Mm-hmm.
It's only what happened when he went to that jail and how he was released from the jail, which made the judge unhappy, and then the judge wanted to send him back. I mean, it's very much a story of the backroom maneuvers, the inner workings of, you know, the judicial system.
Yeah. Tell me about this. Tell me about this judge.
Judge Lawrence Rittenband, now deceased, was a very bright man, very publicity hungry. Interested in having his name in the newspapers. And I think he was just interested in looking good
right.
to the press and to his friends. And, I mean, it's very questionable behavior. We know we have this sometimes now, but
we see that now. Yeah, sure.
Yeah, yeah. Now, it's a very timely story, and I hope you can see it, so I don't have to explain anymore. I don't want to give it away. It's a very tough pitch. You know, it's kind of like my standard line is, despite what Polanski did, it's about how he was screwed over by the judge.
Right.
But I don't want to lessen at all what he did. But
what he's
Polanski
responsible for, yeah.
Yeah, I mean it's a tough case, but he was supposed to be treated fairly, and he wasn't. I mean,
go
ahead.
I'm sorry, but you did get several people in his life. You've already spoken to some of these people to share these things with you, some of which haven't been expressed in decades. Why do you think they were ready and willing to talk to you?
I think just persistence and just seeing that I wasn't after anything sensational, that I really wanted to just get to the truth and
right.
the real facts of the story. I think you can kind of meet someone instantly and figure out what they're about. And I had no ulterior motive. I mean, I was genuinely curious about what happened and wanted those who were there to explain what happened. And I think that's how I got them to talk to me. I mean, granted, it took, you know, over a year to get both the former DA and Polanski's lawyer to agree to talk to me. And that was difficult. I mean, it was difficult. And then one of Polanski's friends, who plays a big role in the film, he didn't even, I mean, documentary filmmaking 101 is, you know, you get your release signed at the beginning. He wouldn't even sign a release until he saw the film because people didn't know, you know, what I was going to do. But they hoped and took a chance and, you know, hopefully, I mean, people are saying that I've been fair. So I think I did what I set out to do. So I'm very excited. It's been a long time. It's been a very difficult story to put together.
I can imagine. I'm fascinated by the documentary filmmaking process, because when you set out to make this film, I mean, you might have one film in mind, and it might turn in a completely different direction and become another film halfway through. Does it constantly kind of redefine itself as you go along?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I'm a people person, so I normally do kind of like funny people stories, but this
right.
wasn't a funny story, and this was a story about the case. But I was very interested in his life, because I think clearly you have to tell the background of his life, at least up to this point, to get to the case. So did the story change? I mean, the story was always two films, and it was trying to make them one. It was his story and the story of the case. And it's kind of like, how do you weave those in and out of each other? And that's very difficult. I had an amazing editor, Joe Beeney, who does all Werner Herzog's films, who was able to really figure out a way in and out. And it was going in and out of Roman's life back into the case. And I think we've succeeded. You know,
Personally,
but hopefully,
I cannot
hopefully
wait to see
succeeded.
It.
Good.
Do you think that he'll ever return to the States?
I don't know. I don't know. I think people should see the film and see what they think. I mean, despite what he did, I mean, here I go again. Despite what he did, he really was treated unfairly.
Yeah.
And I think he should be able to come back, but only because I did all the research.
Right.
So I understand the case, but,
yeah,
I'm not in the DA's office. It's really for the audience to decide. Everybody is going to have their own opinion. And, I mean, the biggest thing is that this is in no way an apology for Polanski. I don't know if I said that. I mean, it was a very hard film to make, because it's a very fine line. Just because it's so delicate. And I was fortunate enough to be able to get all the players to talk about something. And it's a case that haunts everyone. You know, Polanski's lawyer says, "This case will never leave me." I mean, this is a tragedy for everyone involved, and I'm glad that we were able to put it together so people could see the real story.
Yeah, me too. And I'm very anxious to see it. Now, are you seeking distribution at Sundance as well, or do you already have that in place?
No, it was made with the BBC, but we don't have distribution in the U.S.
Okay.
So,
well, keep us updated, because since we've announced your appearance on the show, everyone is just fascinated to watch this movie. Please come back to us and tell us all about your Sundance experience this time around, and give us an update on your film.
Yes.
Oh, I would love to. I would love to.
Thank you so much.
Next time, not from Whole Foods, I promise.
Okay. All right.
I'll be at Ralph's.
That sounds
right.
Good.
Right,
that sounds
bye-bye.
Good. Thank you.
Thanks, guys. Take care.
Thank you, Marina. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye.
That is Marina Zinovich. Her film is Roman Polanski, Wanted and Desired. You know, I had like 10 more questions to ask, but it felt like a delicate thing. Like I couldn't.
He wants people to see the movie, so I mean.
Yeah, and you can't blame her. And yeah. I'm practically wetting myself. I want to see this movie.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's a fascinating thing, and you know, we just don't know. But you know, she's got to sell her movie, so you know, she can't tell us everything.
But by all accounts, I mean, this is going to be quite a film, and it's up for a grand jury prize at Sundance in the documentary arena. And best of luck to her. I mean,
yeah.
we might have just interviewed the grand jury prize winner this year's
That's
Sundance.
That's very true.
It's very true. Yeah. What a fascinating figure. I mean, he's kind of elusive, isn't he, Polanski?
Yeah, I'm. You know, it's like, you know, we like.
what I'm very interested in is I want to see this more than anything, just to see what the things I don't know or the preconceived notions I have that may be very wrong. So.
But that's just it. I didn't know that he actually served time in jail. I
had no idea.
Yeah, I mean, this is the stuff that we've been fed for 30 years.
Yeah.
And apparently there's something else going on while not vindicating Polanski, because obviously, as she made clear, he did what he did, and it was horrendous. But there's more going on there that I would assume has something to do with celebrity and the legal system. And that's something that we're battling with today. Especially, it's not a great time to be a judge in the L.A. area.
No, it's not. Are we going to go there? Please tell me we're
well,
not going
to. Well, that has to be what this film's about, from what I've gathered from her. And she's speaking to the personality of some of these judges. We saw this with Anna Nicole Smith. Remember that judge that whenever he was on camera, he made sure that he got all hot and tempered and started to cry and got the bombast going? He knew that the cameras were on him, and he wanted to be a star.
Right.
I think that's a disease that needs to stay out of the courtroom.
But do you think that started with – where do you think that started? Do you think that started with Judge Ito?
Apparently, it might have started with his Polanski case.
Okay. Right.
Maybe it started before. I mean, stars got in trouble, you know, in other eras in filmmaking. But in the terms of the media circus, I mean, it really reached a fever pitch with O.J., but the media was all over Polanski, too.
I saw him on the news today, you know, I can't believe that he's, over the last couple of months, he's back in the news, but saw him today, it doesn't look good.
That's another judge that knew that the camera was on her.
Yeah.
And, you know, she made it very clear that she was being very stern. And, you know, whether it's... I don't think it's called for, but she's all over the news tonight.
Yeah.
I mean, she's on every channel.
All over the place.
If she would have been Dull Jane, she wouldn't have been. But because she made such an impassioned kind of speech to Simpson, wagging her finger, which she needed to do,
mm-hmm.
I mean, she got massive TV time.
True.
And it's something destructive, I think.
Oh, well, now we have a Wayne Klingman in the chat room brought up Fatty Arbuckle. And what happened
exactly.
to him? Can you imagine if we had the media circus that we had, if you had that back then with Fatty Arbuckle? Oh my!
Well, and you know they were going to make a movie. We talked about this with Chris Farley playing Fatty Arbuckle and that whole Arbuckle debacle.
Right. Yeah.
That would have been a great project.
That would have been. It would have been fascinating. That would have been very interesting. And as Joe Wilson just said, more wide-angle lenses. Okay, hey, that's my comment about the wide-angle lenses.
I love our fans.
Oh, they're great.
Listeners.
They're wonderful. I love it.
They're
all
great.
Right.
So did you want to bring up something else about the foreign films?
The foreign films, and I thought talking the other night, and I just thought maybe the Spanish film, The Orphanage. I thought maybe there's a French movie with an animated film that was got a big reception last year, and I'm not pronouncing it right, but Persepolis, based on the graphic novel about growing up in Iran.
Yes.
I thought these would have been nominated. I thought there's another one, 4 months, 3 weeks, and 2 days.
Two days, right.
That didn't get it. What got the films that got it, now here's the funny thing. I know the directors. Now, this is just a short list. This isn't the final nominees, but... I only know there's a movie from Kazakhstan, Mongol, which was at Harry Knowles' Ain't It Cool News, Butnamathon. That got a great reception. I didn't think that would be on here. Then the Italian movie, The Unknown, which is by the same guy who did Cinema Paradiso. You have Days of Darkness by Denis Arcand, who did The Barbarian Invasions, which did win an Oscar. That's from Canada a couple of years ago. But at none of the films I thought would be on here are on here.
Really?
There's one from Austria called The Counterfeiters, which is, that's supposed to be the favorite.
And this is which group? Which group?
A foreign film. Foreign film. The best foreign film for the Oscars, the shortlist.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to confuse you. I didn't mean to do that on live radio.
Very easily confused.
No, but now, here's the thing. There's Poland has a movie called Cat Inn. I would imagine that's about the Katyn Forest Massacre under Stalin, and that's by the famous Polish director, and I can't pronounce his last name, but he's very famous, Andrzej Wajda, Wajda, you would recognize him. He's made a lot of famous movies. I would think that might be a favorite because he's, you know, been around for so long. But once again, these are films that haven't even been released in this country yet.
Right.
So this threw me for a loop last night.
I'm sorry,
I killed the conversation with that.
Yeah, there's not a big conversation to be had about foreign films that none of us have ever heard of.
Yeah.
But that is something else. And haven't they really always kind of dropped the ball on foreign films and documentaries in particular?
Yeah, documentaries. Now I'm very curious to see what's going to be the documentary, the final ones for that.
Yeah, you'd think that Sicko would have to be.
I would think Sicko and No End in Sight.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Those two would have to be in there, but who knows?
I'm pushing for Camden. I would love
to see that in there, but I don't know.
Yeah. Somebody, Joe Wilson, he wanted to plug something in the room, in the chat room, okay. His show tomorrow night, they've got Patton Oswalt on his show, The Dork Forest, tomorrow. And he's a great comedian. He was voice of the rat. Wasn't he the voice of the rat in Ratatouille?
Yeah, yes, he was.
Yeah, what time is that show?
You know, okay, Joe co-hosts The Dork Forest. Okay, cool.
What time is it air tomorrow,
what
Joe?
What time is it? All right,
really?
We got Sicko, the right type of film for 4 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. So,
yeah, so that's 7 p.m. in the East.
7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time.
It's dorkforestradio.com. You can hear that interview, and we're happy to plug you, Joe, because we're not on tomorrow night.
Yeah.
So no conflict of interest there at all, man. We just want people to know, feel free to call in. We don't bite. We'd love to hear from you, actually.
We'd love to hear from you.
We rarely get calls. If you want to just call in and talk about...
Yeah, really. Feel free.
any movie.
Our line is open.
I'm sick of just sitting here and talking to Jerry. Come on, let's do something else. I'm kidding, man.
I know you're kidding.
So give me your thoughts on Alan J. Pakula. This weekend, you know, we're going to pay tribute to him.
Well, that's the, you know, all the President's Men, obviously, but the Parallax View is one that always grabbed me.
Yeah.
I watched that on, we didn't get cable here until 1989. So I remember watching these movies, of all places, on Bravo when they used to show movies.
Yeah.
And also American Movie Classics before they had commercials and before they became American Movie Crap. They used to have these movies on. And that was, I remember watching that with Warren Beatty. And it's like, I only know Warren Beatty really from Reds and Dick Tracy and Shampoo. Actually, no, Shampoo I knew him from. And Heaven Can Wait, but I've never seen the Parallax View, and I was just like, wow, this is really great.
You know, it was one of those, and it turned out to be a particular genre of strength for Alan Pakula, was the political conspiracy thrillers.
Yes.
They were very popular in the 70s. You know, you had 3 Days of the Condor. You had another one of his films, All the President's Men.
Mm-hmm.
You had various movies out there. The Parallax View tends to be one that's overlooked. And right from its opening scene, the kind of the political assassination at the top of the Space Needle
is brilliant.
It's great.
Stays with you forever.
Yeah. It's a great movie. He had such like feeling for realism.
Mm-hmm.
Just in not only in the characters and the behavior of the characters, but in terms of creating the environment that the characters are in. I mean, you're in a real newsroom in All the President's Men. It's a set.
You are.
But it feels so real because it's down to the last minute detail. It's based upon the real Washington Post newsroom, right down to the trash cans. And it creates a world for the actors to exist in that really lends an authenticity to. And that's why I think about his best movies. They're authentic.
Clues is another one.
Clute, absolutely.
You know which one I love a lot, and I finally watched the whole thing about 3 or 4 years ago. You're gonna laugh at me. Starting Over.
No, Burt Reynolds.
I love that. I finally saw it, and it's like the entire. It came out on DVD, and I watched the whole thing. And that was really like everyone at the top of their game. Really well done.
Yeah, absolutely. That's Burt Reynolds, Joe Clayburgh, Candice Bergen.
Yes, and it's just really good.
Yeah, and Presumed Innocent has always been a favorite movie of mine.
Good. That's a really good film, and that was a big deal because the book was like one of Scott Turow. That was his first novel, I think, in his best novel.
Just to fill people in.
Job.
Just to fill people in, Harrison Ford did two Pakula films. He did Presumed Innocent and The Devil's Own. He wrote the foreword to the biography that we're going to have that biographer on Sunday, Jared Brown, to the book that he wrote on Pakula. And actually, I got an email from Harrison Ford's personal assistant a couple of days ago that said, you know, sadly, he's not available Sunday night for your show. But
no, I hope he's doing as much as he can for Indiana Jones, whatever
but,
he has
yeah,
to do.
Yeah, and then she, but then she said, but thanks for thinking of him and keep in touch. And I was like, yeah, try keeping in touch for Indiana Jones. I'll be in touch.
Yeah, we want him on May 21st, the day before. We want him on, like, the day of the week Indiana Jones comes out.
I was like, I've got a golden ticket. I've got a pathway to Harrison Ford.
Yeah.
This is beautiful.
And that's a, you know, it's interesting because the films he did after Presumed, I like Consenting Adults. I've seen that a couple of times.
Yeah.
I like The Pelican Brief. I thought was one of the better John.
And Chris and I were talking about, we're fascinated by what he might have done with Friday Night Lights, which was to be his next film.
It would have been very interesting though.
Yeah,
not that I don't mind what was made, but under his direction, that would have been something.
Something else, yeah.
Yeah.
We have a call, 262 area code.
Okay.
Let's pick it up. 262, go right ahead.
Hi, how you guys doing tonight?
Hey, man, how you doing?
What's up?
Not much. It's cold in the city of Wisconsin. Like your show. You guys are doing a good job.
Thank you.
Thank you, buddy. We're just excited to have a caller.
Surprised that people won't call in these shows more often.
I don't know why. I don't know what. Are people scared of us?
I think they're scared. I think they're watching internet porn. I don't know. They don't want the sound. You can turn the volume off. We won't know you're watching it. You can turn the volume down.
I'd have to check out that internet porn. But no. I think it's interesting that you bring up Sundance. And all respect to anybody who makes films. And all respect to people who submit something, anything, to Sundance, and get it selected to be shown, because it does take a unique character to get it done, really, truly.
Right.
I was just curious what you thought of some of the more independent film festivals out there, like Trauma Dance, or It Came From Lake Michigan, or some of the other ones which are out there.
I think they're great. I think we've been bombarded with some of them in some regions. But, you know, anything that promotes independent film, anything that promotes, you know, grab a camera, show us your vision. You know, sometimes it's going to be awful, but it promotes creativity and a sense of community around the art of film. I think that's the most important thing. I think the festivals are great. Jerry, do you
agree? Yeah, I agree, especially, you know, there can never be too many because people want to make films, and if there's a way, an avenue, since finding a theater or distribution is so hard, the festival circuit is the way to go. And if you can get on that circuit and you can get festivals to play your films, I don't care what festival it is, and, you know, each state has their couple hundred festivals going on. Just, you know, like, and I think Trauma Dance is wonderful. I think Slam Dance was a really good thing. But they're like little festivals all over the place. But if you can have that avenue where you can show your film, by all means, it's great.
I would agree with you. I think it's good for not only what you mentioned, getting people talking to one another about working on each other's projects and getting more information out there. I think it's good to bring to communities the idea of how good film can be for that community if you become the place to make film.
Right.
And I think the appreciation for good film has soured somewhat, you know, nationally. I think film festivals can only help that out.
Yeah.
And I think that it's good for the economy, too. The economy of the host city.
Absolutely.
Right.
Yeah.
I think you're right. I mean, I think you're very true. And I just want to go back to why people might be burned out on film is the number of times I think we've been going to movies and the movie theaters paying up to $10 to see a show. And I walk out and I go, and what the heck did I spend $10 on this piece for?
Because you've seen it before, you know, and everything playing on the multiplex, I mean, there are varying degrees and there's some great films out now. But for a large part, you feel like you've already seen that movie. And independent films, a lot of times, can dare to be different and dare to be outside of the box. Now, I saw earlier this year, the film festival that I attended, I saw a really beautiful little movie called Quiet City. And we played a little bit of an interview with the filmmaker, but we haven't talked about this movie since then. And it's something that he just grabbed a video camera. It's a story of two people that meet and they just converse over the period of a few days. and it's, they start to form a relationship of tenderness, and it ends with a kiss, you know, and it's a very delicate little movie, but it feels completely authentic, like you're living with these people. And it's something that if a studio would have gotten a hold of, they would have added in, you know, I'm pregnant, you know, I don't want to have the baby, all this extra flourish that takes away from the purity of what that movie is.
You're correct. And the ones that I hang out at, I see a lot of interesting horror films.
Yeah.
Sci-fi films, which gives young people an absolutely perfect way to be creative with low or no money. And
sure.
Now they have to explain to an audience what their idea is. And sometimes it's no more than how much gore can I get flung out on the screen. But usually it's more to it than that, thank God, because the last thing we need is more torture porn.
Yeah,
that's
I think
right.
That's run its course.
You know, you're always going to have the guy that wants to direct another version of stuff that he's already seen. But something special happens when you're working on an independent budget, it seems. You're forced to be more creative.
Mm-hmm.
And that can result in some special stuff sometimes. And you're right, the horror genre, I think a record number of filmmakers are choosing that as their genre of choice to break in with.
Well, I think it's because, I mean, growing up, all the morality stories we get told from Little Red Riding Hood to Hansel and Gretel, and they translate really well into different horror films.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's right.
I think at the same time, people are rediscovering people like H.P. Lovecraft.
The classic.
Yes, they
example.
Are, yeah.
Yeah.
And on their own, because the schools, at least in the state of Wisconsin, aren't teaching them. And they're thinking, oh, my God, you know, this is scary stuff, and I can make a movie with this. And I think that's the thing, too, nowadays, with everything going on in the world, not get political, is the world is becoming a very scary place. There's not a lot of leadership by any parties on what to do about it, and that usually translates, if you look at the stuff with the War of the Worlds radio show and other stuff.
Right.
The same thing with film. People are scared. They're trying to figure a way to be not scared, so they're coming up with ideas for film. I'll be scared for 2 hours of this movie, and maybe the real world will have gone away.
Right.
You're absolutely right, man. And we talk about this a lot on the show, how more than any other genre, the horror film genre really speaks to what's going on in the world today in a very kind of direct emotional way. Horror, for some reason, that's the genre that you can really explore these themes in.
Yeah. It's from this, it really, like, from, like, bringing up, you know, George Romero has a new Dead film coming out, Diary of the Dead.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And, you know, I don't want to... Not that we need to promote the film anymore. It's got a built-in Cloverfield, kind of, if you really think about it. It addresses, like, that kind of post-9/11 fear and anxiety, from what I can tell from the trailer, at least. I don't know.
Right.
But, I think that is the genre which you can really...
Which you felt that way about The Mist, too.
The Mist is one of the better political allegories of the year, of last
really,
year.
I thought it was a substantially good film.
Yeah.
I didn't necessarily see it as a political allegory, but then that's me.
Right.
Yeah, and I didn't see The Mist, but you were talking about Lovecraft and the kind of classic literature that people are thankfully going back to. But when I was in school, I read two stories, you know, short stories that really moved me. And they're both kind of horrifying. And one of them, it's actually my favorite story, and it's called The Good Man is Hard to Find. It's Flannery O'Connor. Family's car breaks down. This escaped prisoner with his buddies systematically kills the family one by one. And it seems like I've been trying to get the rights to that book forever. And that and The Lottery.
Well, The Lottery's been, they've made that couple of times.
I get the sense from The Lottery, though, there's some of that in The Mist, though.
There is. And I think what I thought The Mist did that, you know, that none of the political films did, and also as Anthony T. brought up in the chat from 28 Weeks Later, also was very good about addressing a lot of the fears in the post-9/11 world. But
yeah.
The Mist, this supermarket, is just this microcosm of all of society. And when you take the laws, and when the laws disappear, the law is the only thing that separates us from the animals. And, you know, we devolve into this savagery.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just, it's a fascinating film. And it's a frightening film, not because of the monsters, but just because of the human behavior.
Yeah.
It reminds you I'm going to use this analogy, and I didn't dare write about it, but it does remind you, like, of during World War II or before, when the Germans would come in and they say, "Look, you round up, you round up your Jews, and we'll let you go." And it reminded me something along those lines of, like, Eastern Europe almost.
Yeah.
And it really sent a shiver down my spine.
You know, and I, the most terrifying, and I happen to think that War of the Worlds, the Spielberg remake, there's something missing from it. I can't quite express what it is. But when it does work, it works really well. And it never works as well for me as when they're in chaos. They're in the car. They're trying to. He's trying to get his children out. And people just become barbarians.
Mm-hmm.
They're fighting to survive. They pull them out. You know, there's just mass hysteria of that crowd.
Oh,
that's
yeah,
what,
before
that's
they get
what
to the ferry.
That's what scared me about
yeah.
that movie.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Do that. If you look at Hotel Rwanda, which is not a horror film.
Yes.
But, oh, yeah. Ooh.
I mean, that really, truly happened, but yet nobody wanted to see the movie. Is it because that we don't want to, we can't relate, we fear to relate to that in real life, but yet we'll see War of the Worlds?
You hit it right on the head.
Yeah. I think it's so important for movies like Hotel Rwanda to exist. But I think that a lot of the movies that we're talking about, like The Mist and what Romero does, they're experts at kind of putting in the social context and wrapping it around an entertainment.
Yeah.
You know, that's particularly challenging, and that's their strength. I think that that's pretty much what you got to do. You know, if you want to play out to the masses, you got to be very kind of sneaky about it.
Now, this is really interesting. I've had this discussion this morning with someone. You guys are familiar with a movie called Triumph of the Will?
Yeah.
Lenny,
yeah.
You know, and that was obviously, you know, it's a very propaganda-centered film. It has a purpose. And I'm wondering if today, I don't think anybody would sit down and come up with a new way to do Triumph of the Will. Hillary Clinton might. But that being said, I think you could do that in a film, like a horror film or a science fiction film, you know, easy enough done. And that's one of the things that really bothered me. You remember Starship Troopers, the movie?
I was just about to say Starship Troopers, okay.
You know, I mean, I was so disappointed they didn't have powered armor suits because I wanted to sit there and see one big bloodbath with Space Marines versus alien bug things, right?
Right, right.
But I get that as a political film. The guy, I thought, was making a political point.
He yeah. was. Paul Verhoeven's no stranger to politics.
I think really good critics pick that up. That it's a really kind of sharp. You can appreciate it on a B movie level. You know, a bug movie.
It was kind of ahead of its time in one sense.
Yeah, I'll never forget though. I had such a reaction to the film. The way one scene was played. It was Michael Ironside. I remember being in the theater watching it. There's a very dramatic, like, pan shot as he's looking at one of the victims, and he turns around with his back turned towards the camera. He turns his face to the camera and said, "It sucked his brains out." And it was read so dramatically, and I was the only one in the theater. I was wetting my pants. I was laughing so hard. It was embarrassing.
Well, I appreciate you guys letting me talk to you guys at length. So I'm going to
take
off now.
Oh, absolutely. We appreciate it.
Not a problem. I hope.
Thank you so much, man.
Not a problem. Best of luck with your show. If anything I can ever do for you, this is get a hold of me. I, too, have a show here and that to do any self-promotion, and you can get a hold of me that way.
Well, tell the listeners where they can find your show.
My show is Indie Film in Wisconsin, where I talk about different independent-type films going on. I talk about a film festival that I help do. I try to get calls in. I'm looking for ways to help the first, second, third-time filmmaker to get the skill sets that they need to make it to.
Oh, that's great.
Well, thank you, sir. I really appreciate it.
That is great, man.
That's a wonderful service.
Thank you for listening to our show and supporting us. And let us know if there's anything that we can do for you in the future, man. We'll be happy to do it.
Well, I'll take up that offer right now. I need Amanda Tapping to come to my next festival.
You need a who?
Amanda Tapping. Smash on Stargate.
Oh, yeah. How do we
and
do
I know
that?
You guys know how to get a hold of her.
Well, do you have? Are you on MySpace at all?
I am.
Do you have Movie Geeks United as one of your friends?
No. Well, I'll look you guys up.
Do that and send me an email and give me the name that you want, and I will help you out.
Thank you, sir. I really appreciate that.
No problem at all, man. Thanks for listening, and
yeah.
thanks for being a fellow movie geek. We appreciate
thank
it.
Thank you, sir. Have a great day now.
You too,
buddy. Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.
Great calls. We're making miracles happen.
We're making miracles happen. That was interesting because he brought up
he was great.
He was awesome, but he brought up, and this is really funny, he brought up Triumph of the Will, and then he was talking, and I was thinking Starship Troopers, and sure enough, he said Starship Troopers. And it's crazy how that the Starship Troopers, because there is there's a lot of imagery, but there is some of the, you could say, obviously with the military, a fascist, he has this fascist heart on Verhoeven with the military in that film, the second half. And I just sort of, okay, Starship Troopers, yeah, that's where we're going.
That's the thing about people that love film, though, on an equal level. And we're not talking about film snobs, you know, people that think that they know the academics of film, but people that truly appreciate it.
Yeah.
They are linked, you know? They are connected in a way. Don't you find that?
People might think we're snobs, but to be able to talk about There Will Be Blood and then go on to talk about something like Caddyshack in the same sentence, come on, we're not snobs, really. Don't be scared.
Don't be scared.
And don't be fooled by cheap imitations.
Don't be scared and confused. I'm always make that very clear. I approach movies from a purely emotional level. And if it can stimulate me intellectually, that's fine too. But movies are an emotional experience for
Absolutely,
me.
They are.
Yeah, and there's some movies that exist only intellectually, and I can appreciate them, but I can't let them in as easily.
No, they're hard to let in, and especially lately, there are some that I can name that it's just like, it's like you watch it and you're like, okay, and they're not the ones that you want to go back to immediately either. You know?
There are actors like that too. That's why I respond as I do to actors like Pacino, Sean Penn, Jessica Lange. Because they're like open wounds, you know. They're all powerful emotion. They're vulnerable.
Mm-hmm.
And there are actors that are more intellectual, and I'm thinking of John Malkovich. Actors like that William Hurt, that tend to live in their brain, and they're amazing actors. But the ones I gravitate to are the ones that are purely emotional.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, Malkovich is like that, and that's what made, I think, being John Malkovich so much fun, that he's willing to poke fun, and he sort of knew that.
Well, that's what makes William Hurt so brilliant in Accidental Tourist, and I could look at him and I could say that's a perfect performance.
Yeah.
Because it's a character that completely lives in his head.
Mm-hmm.
You know? He doesn't let anything in.
No, he doesn't.
Yeah, it's a great movie, and it's a comedy, and it's a tragedy. It's one of those movies that it's seamless. You can watch it and appreciate it as both, a comedy and a tragedy. And but with a great, happy, not at all sentimentalized ending.
Right.
Yeah, I love that movie.
It's a great movie.
Rent it, Accidental Tourist. Right now it's in a special edition DVD. Rent it. Go out. Get it. Okay, it's been a great show, man. I've enjoyed talking to our caller. I've enjoyed talking to you for the past.
It's been great. I wonder what did because I didn't get to hear all the composer Brian Taylor. How was that?
It was very good. It was really good. He was very informative about his collaboration with Stallone. You know, you can always listen to the archive.
I know. Thank you. I realize that. No, because I've heard some of the music from the film, and it sounds like he really does a great homage, but adds a lot of new stuff to that, and it sounds really great.
We talked a lot about Goldsmith.
He's a great one. He's one of the best.
Yeah, and he agrees. I mean, and they've crossed paths before, apparently. He did. Goldsmith was replaced on the Richard Donner film Timeline. And Brian Tyler was brought in to replace his score. Brian Tyler did a Star Trek Enterprise series, you know, and Goldsmith had made a big name for himself doing those themes.
Right, but he did. Was, he did.
Yeah. So they cross paths in weird ways. And they're very adamant about maintaining the Goldsmith theme, according to his conversations with Stallone.
Okay, that's cool.
Because it was the heart of the Rambo character. So
it is.
About
the music, just to go back, and speaking of his emotion, the music is definitely a huge part of that. You know, you talked about them showing Jaws without the music, and it didn't go over well. And you know, it's true with a lot of the great films. It is the music is really this front and center, the key, the driving force.
Yeah. We thank everyone out there for joining us on the chat room and listening in. Make sure you guys join us on Sunday, a big show.
The Air I Breathe.
Just wondering how they get that cast alone.
Mm-hmm.
That'll make up that segment. And the Alan J. Pakula tribute, a filmmaker that is not honored enough. And we're going to do him justice on Sunday. Next Wednesday, Philip Baker Hall, a major character actor next Wednesday. And we're working on some great interviews throughout the remainder of this month into February, and maybe some big names we're working on. So stay tuned, guys. Thanks for listening tonight. As
Thank
always,
you.
Jerry, talk to you later.
I talk to you. Good night, everyone.
Good night, guys.